That taunt should have made it easier for me to hate him, but somehow it failed. Although I called back to him, "You are going no further than the mud in the river bottom, old friend. The next catfish that I roast on the spit, I will call Rasfer." He was the first prisoner to be lifted onto the wooden gate. It took three men on the parapet of the wall, straining on the rope, while at the same time four more shoved from below. They held him there as one of the regimental armourers climbed the ladder beside him with a stone-headed mallet in his fist. There were no more jokes from Rasfer when the first of the thick copper nails was driven through the flesh and bones of his huge calloused feet. He roared and swore and twisted in the grip of the men who held him, and the crowd cheered and laughed and urged on the sweating armourer. It was only when the nails had been driven home, and the hammerman had climbed down to admire his handiwork, that the flaws in this novel form of punishment became evident. Rasfer howled and roared, swinging upside down, with the blood trickling slowly down his legs. The hang of his pendulous paunch was reversed, and the huge hairy bunch of his genitalia flapped against his belly button. As he twisted and struggled, the nails slowly ripped through the web of his flesh between his toes, until finally they tore entirely free. Rasfer fell back to earth and flopped around like a beached fish. The spectators loved the show and howled with mirth at his antics. Encouraged by the spectators, his executioners lifted him back onto the gate, and the armourer with his hammer climbed back up the ladder to drive in more nails. In order to pin Rasfer more securely and to prevent him struggling, Thanos ordered his hands as well as his feet to be nailed to the gate. This time it was more successful. Rasfer hung head down, his limbs spread like some monstrous starfish. He was no longer bellowing, for the mass of intestines in his belly was sagging down and pressing on his lungs. He struggled for every breath he drew, and had none over for shouting. One at a time, the other condemned men were lifted onto the gate and nailed there, and the crowd hooted and applauded. Only Busty the Cruel made no sound and gave them poor sport. As the day wore on, the sun beat down upon the crucified victims, and the heat grew steadily stronger. By noon, the prisoners were so weak with pain and thirst and loss of blood that they hung as quietly as the carcasses on butchers' hooks. The spectators began to lose interest and drifted away. Some of the barons lasted longer than the others. Busty went on breathing all that day. Only as the sun was setting did he take one deep, shuddering breath and finally hang inert. Rasfer was the toughest of them all. Long after Busty was gone, he hung on. His face was filled with dark blood, so it swelled to twice its normal size. His tongue protruded from between his lips like a thick slice of purple liver. Once in a while he would utter a deep groan, and his eyes would flutter open. Every time this happened, I shared his agony. The last of my hatred for him had long ago shriveled and died, and I was racked with pity, as I would have been for any other tortured animal. The crowd had long ago dispersed, and I sat alone on the empty stand. Not attempting to hide his disgust at such a brutal duty thrust upon him by the royal command, Thanos had stood to his post until sunset. Then finally he had handed over the death watch to one of his captains and strode back into the city, leaving us to our vigil. There were only 10 guards below the gate, myself on the stand and a few beggars lying like bundles of rags at the foot of the wall. The torches on either side of the gate guttered and flickered in the night breeze of the river, casting an eerie light over the macabre scene. Rasfer groaned again, and I could stand it no longer. I took a jar of beer from my basket and climbed down to speak to the captain. We knew each other from the desert, and he laughed and shook his head at my request. "You are a soft-hearted fool, Tater. The bastard is so far gone he's not worth worrying about," he told me. "But I will look the other way for a while. Be quick about it." I went to the gate, and Rasfer's head was on a level with my own. I called his name softly, and his eyes fluttered open. I had no way of telling how much he understood, but I whispered, "I have a little beer to wet your tongue." He made a soft gulping sound in his throat. His eyes were looking at me. If he still had feeling, I knew his thirst must be a torment of hell. I dribbled a few drops from the jar over his tongue, careful not to let any of it run back into his nose. He made a weak and futile effort to swallow. It would have been impossible, even if he had been stronger. The liquid ran out of the corners of his mouth and down his cheeks into the dung-caked hair. He closed his eyes, and that was the moment I was waiting for. I slipped my dagger out of the folds of my shawl. Carefully, I placed the point behind his ear, and then with a sharp movement, drove it into the hilt. His back arched in the final spasm, and then he relaxed into death. I drew out the blade. There was very little blood, and I hid the dagger in my shawl and turned away. "May dreams of paradise waft you through the night, Taita," the captain of the guard called after me. But I had lost my voice and could not reply. I never thought that I would weep for Rasfa. And maybe I never did so. Perhaps I wept only for myself. At Pharaoh's command, the return of the court to Elephantine was initially delayed for a month. The king had his new treasure to dispose of and was in buoyant mood. In all the time I had known him, I had never seen him so happy and contented. I was pleased for him. By this time I held the old man in real and warm affection. Some nights I sat up late with him and his scribes, going over the accounts of the royal treasury, which now emitted a decidedly rosy glow. At other times I was summoned by Pharaoh to consultations on the alterations to the mortuary temple and the royal tomb that he was now better able to afford. I calculated that at least half of the recently revealed treasure would go into the tomb with Pharaoh. He selected all the finest jewellery from Intef's hoard and sent almost 15 tucks of bullion to the goldsmiths in his temple, to be turned into funerary objects. Nevertheless, he found time to send for Tanus to advise him on military matters. He had now recognized Tanus as one of the foremost generals in his army. I was present at some of these meetings. The threat from the false pharaoh in the lower kingdom was ever present, and preyed on all our minds. Such was Tanus' favor with the king that he was able to make the most of these fears and to persuade Pharaoh to divert a small part of Intef's treasure to the building of 5 new squadrons of war galleys and to re-equipping all the guards' regiments with new weapons and sandals, although he was unable to persuade the king to make up the arrears in the pay for the army. Many of the regiments had not been paid for the last half year. Morale in the army was much boosted by these reinforcements, and every soldier knew whom to thank for them. They roared like lions and raised their clenched right fists in salute when Tanus inspected their massed formations. Most times, when Tanus was summoned to the royal audience, my mistress found some excuse to be present, although she had the good sense to keep in the background on these occasions. She and Tanus directed such looks at each other that I feared they might scorch the false beard of the pharaoh. Fortunately, nobody but myself seemed to notice these flashing messages of passion. Whenever my mistress knew that I was to see Tanus in private, she burdened me with long and ardent messages for him. On my return I carried his replies, which matched hers in length and fire. Fortunately, these outpourings were highly repetitive, and memorizing them was not a great hardship. My Lady Lostris never tired of urging me to find some subterfuge by which she and Tanus might be alone together once more. I admit that I feared enough for my own skin and for the safety of my mistress and our unborn child not to devote all my energies and ingenuity to satisfying this request of hers. Once, when I did tentatively approach Tanus with my mistress's invitation to a meeting, he sighed and refused it with many protestations of love for her. That interlude in the tombs of Tras was sheer madness, Taita. I never intended to compromise the Lady Lostri's honour. But for the Khamsin, it would never have happened. We cannot take that risk again. Tell her that I love her more than life itself. Tell her our time will come, for the mazes of Amon-Ra have promised it to us. Tell her I will wait for her through all the days of my life. On receiving this loving message, my mistress stamped her foot, called her true love a stubborn fool who cared nothing for her, broke a cup and 2 bowls of coloured glass, hurled a jewelled mirror, which had been a gift from the king, into the river, and finally threw herself onto the bed where she wept until supper time. Apart from his military duties, which included supervising the building of the new fleet of galleys, Tanus these days was much occupied with the reorganization of his father's estates that he had at last inherited. On these matters he consulted me almost daily. Not surprisingly, the estates had never been preyed upon by the shrikes while they belonged to Lord Intef, and accordingly they were all prosperous and in good repair. Thus Thanos had become overnight one of the most wealthy men in the Upper Kingdom. Although I tried my best to dissuade him, he spent much of his private fortune in making up the arrears in pay to his men and in re-equipping his beloved Blues. Of course, his men loved him all the more for this generosity. Not content with these profligate expenditures, Thanos sent out his captains, Kratos and Remren and Astes, to gather up all the crippled and blinded veterans of the river wars who now existed by begging in the streets of Thebes. Thanos installed this riffraff in one of the large country villas that formed part of his inheritance, and although slops and kitchen refuse would have been too good for them, he fed them on meat and corn cakes and beer. The common soldiers cheered Thanos in the streets and drank his health in the taverns. When I told my mistress of Thanos' mad extravagances, she was so encouraged by them that she immediately spent hundreds of deben, of the gold that I had earned for her, in buying and equipping a dozen buildings which she turned into hospitals and hostels for the poor people of Thebes. I had already earmarked this gold for investment in the corn market, and though I wrung my hands and pleaded with her, she could not be moved. Needless to say, it was the long-suffering slave Tater who was responsible for the day-to-day management of this latest folly of his mistress, although she visited her charity homes every day. Thus it was possible for any loafer and drunkard in the Twin Cities to scrounge a free meal and a comfortable bed from us. If that was not enough, they could have their bowl of soup served to them by my mistress's own fair hand, and their running sores and purging bowels treated by one of the most eminent physicians in this very Egypt. I was able to find a few young unemployed scribes and disenchanted priests who loved people more than gods or money. My mistress took them into her employ. I led this little band on nocturnal hunts through the back alleys and slum quarters of the city. Nightly we gathered up the street orphans. They were a filthy, verminous bunch of little savages, and very few of them came with us willingly. We had to pursue and catch them like wildcats. I received many lusty bites and scratches in the process of bathing their filth-encrusted little bodies and shaving their hair that was so thick with lice and nits that it was impossible to drag a comb through it. We housed them in one of my mistress's new hostels. Here the priests began the tedious process of taming them, while the scribes started on the long road of their education. Most of our captives escaped within the first few days, and returned to the gutters where they belonged. However, some of them stayed on in the hostel. Their slow transformation from animals to human beings delighted my mistress, and gave me more pleasure than I had suspected could ever come from such an unlikely source. All my protests against the manner in which my mistress was wasting our substance were in vain, and I vowed that if I were to be embalmed and laid in my tomb before my allotted time, the blame would surely rest entirely with these two young idiots, whom I had taken under my wing, and who rewarded me by consistently ignoring my best advice. Needless to say, it was my mistress and not me whom the widows and the cripples blessed and presented with their pitiful little gifts of wilting wild flowers, cheap beads and tattered scraps of papyrus containing poorly written text from the Book of the Dead. As she walked abroad, the common people held up their brats for her blessing and tried to touch the hem of her skirt as though it was some religious talisman. She kissed the grubby babies, a practice which I warned her would endanger her health, and she scattered copper pieces to the loafers with as much care as a tree drops its autumn leaves. "This is my city," she told me. "I love it, and I love every person in it. Oh, Taita, I dread the return to Elephantine. I hate to leave my beautiful Thebes." "Is it the city you hate to leave?" I asked. "Or is it a certain uncouth soldier who lives here?" She slapped me, but lightly. "Is there nothing you hold sacred, not even love, that is pure and true? For all your scrolls and grand language, you are at heart a barbarian."